Mrs. Trenham called me in for a cup of tea, and when I came out, it was fully daylight. But the sky was a burdened grey, and the sparse trees near the house strained their bare branches against the wind, which drove in long, icy gusts over the white, empty miles of moor. It was what the Yorkshireman called a thin wind, or sometimes a lazy wind. The kind that couldn't be bothered to blow round you, but went straight through instead. It made me feel that the best place on earth was by the side of this bright fire in the farmhouse kitchen. Most people would have felt like that, but not old Tip. He was capering around as Peter loaded a flat cart with some hay bales for the young cattle in the outside barns, and as Peter shook the reins and the cob set off over the fields, he leapt onto the back of the cart. As I threw my tackle into the boot, I looked back at the old dog, legs braced against the uneven motion, tail waving, barking defiance at the cold world. I carried away the memory of Tip, who scorned the softer things, and slept in what he considered the place of honour, at his master's door. A little incident like this has always been able to brighten my day. Unfortunately, I have the kind of job where things of this kind happened. And sometimes, it isn't even a happening. Just a single, luminous phrase. As when I was examining a cow one morning while its neighbour was being milked. The milker was an old man and he was having trouble. He was sitting well into the cow, his cloth-capped head buried in her flank, the bucket gripped tightly between his knees, but the stool kept rocking about as the cow fidgeted and weaved. Twice she kicked the bucket over, and she had an additional little trick of anointing her tail with particularly liquid feces, then lashing the old man across the face with it. Finally, he could stand it no longer. Leaping to his feet, he dealt a puny blow at the cow's scraggy back and emitted an exasperated shout.
"Stand still, thou sitting-out Bovril!"
Or the day when I had to visit Luke Benson at his smallholding in Hillam Village. Luke was a powerful man of about 60, and had the unusual characteristic of speaking always through his clenched teeth. He literally articulated every word by moving only his lips, showing the rows of square, horse-like incisors clamped tightly together. It lent a peculiar intensity to his simplest utterance. As he spoke, his eyes glared. Most of his conversations consisted of scathing remarks about the other inhabitants of Hillam. In fact, he seemed to harbour a cordial dislike of the human race in general. Yet, strangely enough, I found him a very reasonable man to deal with. He accepted my diagnosis of his animal's ailments without question, and appeared to be trying to be friendly by addressing me repeatedly as Jims, which was the nearest he could get to my name with his teeth together. His fiercest hatred was reserved for his neighbour and fellow smallholder, a little lame man called Gil, to whom Luke referred invariably and unkindly as Yon Opin Youth. A bitter feud had raged between them for many years, and I'd seen Luke smile on only two occasions. Once, when Mr. Gill's sow lost its litter, and again, when he had a stack burnt down. When Mr. Gill's wife ran away with a man who came round the farm selling brushes, it caused a sensation. Nothing like that had ever happened in Hillam before, and a wave of delighted horror swept through the village. This, I thought, would be the high point of Luke Benson's life, and when I had to visit a heifer of his, I expected to find him jubilant. But Luke was gloomy. As I examined and treated his animal, he remained silent, and it wasn't until I went into the kitchen to wash my hands that he spoke. He glanced round warily at his wife, a gaunt, grim-faced woman who was applying black lead to the grate. "You'll have heard about yon Opin Youth missus running off," he said. "Yes," I replied, "I did hear about it." I waited for Luke to gloat, but he seemed strangely ill at ease. He fidgeted until I had finished drying my hands, then he glared at me and bared his strong teeth.
"I'll tell you something, Jems," he ground out. "I wish someone would take my bugger."
And there was that letter from the Bramleys. That really made me feel good. You don't find people like the Bramleys now. Radio, television and the motor car have carried the outside world into the most isolated places, so that the simple people you used to meet on the lonely farms are rapidly becoming like people anywhere else. There are still a few left, of course. Old folk who cling to the ways of their fathers, and when I come across any of them, I like to make some excuse to sit down and talk with them and listen to the old Yorkshire words and expressions which have almost disappeared. But even in the '30s, when there were many places still untouched by the flood of progress, the Bramleys were in some ways unique. There were four of them, three brothers, all middle-aged bachelors, and an older sister, also unmarried, and their farm lay in a wide, shallow depression in the hills. You could just see the ancient tiles of Scar House through the top branches of the sheltering trees if you stood outside the pub in Drewburn Village, and in the summer it was possible to drive down over the fields to the farm. I had done it a few times, the bottles in the boot jingling and crashing as the car bounced over the rig and furrow. The other approach to the place was right on the other side through Mr. Broom's stackyard, and then along a track with ruts so deep that only a tractor could negotiate it. There was, in fact, no road to the farm, but that didn't bother the Bramleys because the outside world held no great attraction for them. Miss Bramley made occasional trips to Derby on market days for provisions, and Herbert, the middle brother, had come into town in the spring of 1929 to have a tooth out, but apart from that, they stayed contentedly at home. A call to Scar House always came as rather a jolt, because it meant that at least 2 hours had been removed from the working day. In all but the driest weather, it was safer to leave the car at Mr. Broom's and make the journey on foot. One February night at about 8 o'clock, I was splashing my way along the track, feeling the mud sucking at my Wellingtons. It was to see a horse with colic, and my pockets were stuffed with the things I might need. Arecoline, phials of morphia, a bottle of paraphoroxia. My eyes were half closed against a steady drizzle, but about half a mile ahead I could see the lights of the house winking among the trees.